Oborne and Hella on Cricket, brought to you by the Chiswick Calendar.
Good morning, I'm Peter Oborne, and I'm in Wiltshire where it is the most beautiful sunny morning.
Good morning from me, Richard Heller, at my residence, Rubato Towers, in southeast London, where it's also a beautiful sunny morning. Lots to talk about this week. We're going to pick out some more issues from the latest wisdom. But first, I thought we'd talk about the very important Times interview recently between Mike Atherton and Nathan Leeman, who's the official data analyst for the England cricket team. And our thanks to our friend Jonathan Collett for pointing this out to us.
I must admit, it is the most massively important interview, isn't it? I've never realised how much intelligence and analysis and advanced mathematical analysis went into the creation of a modern cricket team.
Exactly. This is quite a new development in cricket. It was quite common in American sport, particularly baseball and American football. But in cricket, we haven't seen the use of detailed mathematical data to influence player selections for teams and individual matches, to influence who should bowl and bat and when and where, to influence field settings, and even, in one case, to influence on-field decisions. They're basically measuring players' performances as bowlers, batters and fielders. There have been basic stats in cricket for a very long time, but they've now got very refined averages showing how a player performs in particular conditions, what sort of opposition he's best at, if he's a batsman, whether he's good against left-arm bowlers or right-arm bowlers. Cricket statistics have got much more granular, I think is the term, and you can apply them much more scientifically to predict how players will perform in particular circumstances. It's interesting, this detailed mathematical modelling, I think it only works with players of a certain level of ability, because you need players whose performance is predictable. The sort of players like us and the sort of players we play with, the performances tend to be pretty random.
What was particularly interesting about this man who I'd never heard of before, Nathan Leeman, is A, that he's the England Test match analyst, but he was coming into the 2020 game as much of an outsider as we are, and he was applying his remarkable mathematical analysis techniques to the 2020 game, having applied them to the Test match game, and he was doing it with the Pakistan Super League and for the Multan Sultans, which is a team, actually, which we know. Funnily enough, we were in Multan last year, and Ali Khan Tareen, the owner of the Multan Sultans, was very kind to us. We played in the Multan National Stadium. Muin Ali is my all-time, apart from Basil de Oliveira, is my all-time cricket hero. So, and Andy Fleur, former coach of the England team, is now coaching them. So I felt a tremendous affinity with the Multan Sultans, and they have the best cricket analysis in the world, courtesy of this man, Nathan Leeman. And he was applying skills for the first time to 2020 and talking about it in a hugely intelligent and interesting way to Michael Atherton.
He was. This application of mathematics to cricket, very much associated with T20. Obviously, T20 being shorter and simpler, it is a little more predictable and a little easier to model. But he makes the important point, Nathan Leeman, that T20 teams are basically owned by business leaders who are accustomed to use quantities of data for decision-making in business. So what we're seeing here in T20 is owners treating players more and more as capital assets and commodities, as we also see in soccer.
One of the really cheerful things, though, about it, this hard-headed analysis, ruthless business analysis, identified the fact that the best bowlers in T20 are wrist spinners, who were basically written out for so many years from the Test match game. But actually, analytically, they are the best. So Multan Sultans had three wrist spinners, thanks to his analysis. That was the bowler you needed.
Very much so. Our friend Abdul Qadir would have rejoiced in that discovery, though he made it himself years ago when he pioneered the restoration of leg spin in limited over cricket as well as first class. A couple of other things I found interesting results of the data analysis. There's no need for a good wicketkeeper, says Lehman in T20, because so very few balls in T20 go through to the wicketkeeper, maybe 10 or less in a match of 120 deliveries. The other interesting thing is that bowlers in T20 are as important as batters, even though they very, very rarely bowl a side all out. The other most important thing I found in that interview was how strongly Lehman believes in the on-field captain, and rather than running teams from off the field, you know, from the sides by coaches or managers, or worst of all, having them run by owners. And he makes the point, cricket is still something settled by the human factor, you know, the ability of players to make split-second decisions on the field.
Yeah, like the famous Stokes catch or Lyons fumble at the critical moment when he should be running somebody out. You know, it all comes down in the end to that human factor, and even the most brilliant statistical analysis back in the pavilion can't affect that.
Yes, I also found it interesting too that Lehman's not just a data geek, he's one of us rare breed of cricket novelists. I haven't had the pleasure of reading his novel. It was reviewed in last year's Wisden, The Test, viewed by Tanya Aldred, about a stand-in captain of England against Australia. It's an account of the emotional life of travelling cricketers, and it reduced her to tears.
I think we ought to read this book and review it in a future podcast, Richard. That's really interesting. I mean, also, you don't normally find mathematicians, statistical analysis people, who have got that emotional insight which a novel requires.
Just touching on one final point from Nathan Lehman in this interview, Michael Atherton asked him about mathematical modelling in the coronavirus crisis, and Lehman said that he couldn't predict what's going to happen, but he did say that behaviour really does affect the rate of progress of the disease. And so all the cricketers who are frustrated by being locked at home, they do have the satisfaction of knowing that they're doing something for their countries and for the world.
I have to say, it's very painful. I mean, the weather for the last few weeks, Richard, has been so beautiful. And here we are in mid-April. We'd have played a couple of weekends, or maybe three weekends of cricket by now. We'd be on to the second or third round of first-class county championship matches. It's been the most perfect start to a season.
It's almost as if somebody was mocking us. Some higher power were mocking us. I think we've got to accept things as they are. And in this long period of lockdown, I've been composing a philosopher's cricket team. And the first candidate we have for that, mentioned briefly last week, Soren Kierkegaard, who was a very, very important figure in early Danish cricket. And some of our listeners wanted to know more about this. Soren was a very keen cricketer. He was nicknamed Fruit Loaf after the bread he invented for serving at tea time. He was a very nervous batsman, and he took an unusual stance well behind the stumps, and this became known as taking the Kierkegaard, but it actually never caught on. However, he was a really fine bowler. He gave his off-breaks a terrific rip, but unfortunately, this was his tragedy, he bowled them overarm before this had been legalised. And he was no-balled out of the early Danish game. And this experience led him to seek the consolations of philosophy, but he never really recovered, and the loss of Kierkegaard's cricket career was the reason why he invented existential despair.
That is all information which comes completely fresh to me, Richard.
Well, I think it comes fresh to a lot of people. More philosophers in coming weeks, starting in chronological order with Socrates, who was a very fine opening batsman for Athens versus Sparta.
What other matters have we got just arising from Wisden 2020?
Well, we touched on the obituary of our friend Charles Williams, but I hadn't noticed at the time that it never mentioned that he was the stepfather of Justin Welby, who's now the Archbishop of Canterbury. And I asked Charles once if his stepson had had any interest in cricket, but he said, sadly, no. When he went to Eton, he became an oarsman. And I think this is a great loss to the Episcopal bench, and it shows again what the Church of England lost when they didn't choose David Sheppard.
I must admit, I was once told by a bishop, I won't name him because he might be embarrassed, but I took this well-known bishop to lunch at Christopher's, a restaurant in Covent Garden. And he said that David Shepherd was actually destined to get Canterbury, but he was known to be very left-wing. And Mrs. Thatcher, then Prime Minister, didn't like this. But the church establishment was left-wing, and it was determined to get a left-winger in as Archbishop. And so they, when Runcie, or the great Archbishop Runcie, stepped down, they thought they would, but they bowled a googly at the Prime Minister. So they gave her two to choose. One was the obvious candidate, that was Archbishop Hapgood of York, who was quite socially concerned and left-wing. And the other was this obscure figure who nobody had heard of, then the Bishop of Bath. He was only been Bishop of Bath for about 9 months, and he was notoriously, he was a right-winger, but he didn't really have a record. And they reckoned that if they offered her Carey or Hapgood, she'd obviously have to go to the established figure, Hapgood. And of course, being Margaret Thatcher, she chose this obscure man from Bath, Carey, and he became Archbishop of Canterbury. I don't think he was interested in cricket, mind you.
No, I hope there's some cricketing bishops available for Justin Welby's successor. Just on David Shepherd, we spoke of last week and this, our friend Afzal Ahmed from Karachi sent us a very nice reminder of John Arlott's first visit to apartheid South Africa and the immigration form he had to fill out.
Oh, yes. John Arlott, this is a very important moment and is an example of why John Arlott, in my opinion, was the greatest English cricket writer of all time, or cricket commentator. And so Arlott is brought there. It's in the 50s. Apartheid has just been installed at its most barbaric. And he's asked to fill in a form saying, which race do you belong to? And Arlott, of course, said human race. Oh. And of course, he went on to play an enormous role in the epic journey made by Basil D'Oliveira, an unknown coloured cricketer, it was then called, who was ineligible to play first-class cricket in white South Africa, in apartheid South Africa. And I spoke to Basil D'Oliveira. I remember it was very moving. I said to him, Basil, why did you write to John Arlott? He wrote a letter to John Arlott out of the blue in 1960. And he said, and I said, why did you write it? He said, it was something about his voice. I'd hear John Arlott on the World Service, and there was something about the compassion and the richness and the humanity in his voice that told me, as a young man playing cricket and working as a printer in apartheid South Africa, that I should write him a letter. And it was, and he wrote the letter. And, you know, most people would simply ignore a letter like that or just say it's impossible. But Arlott made it his business to find Basil D'Oliveira a role in English cricket. And that set him on the path to play for England. And, of course, it was a story which led to the cancellation of the 1968 England tour of South Africa and played a role in the end of apartheid. It's a very moving story. I do think that John Arlott was a truly great and wonderful man.
Very much so.
Moving from the sublime to the ridiculous, I'm still intrigued, and we've received a number of requests following our discussion last week of the run-out of Geoffrey Archer in the game where Lord Field Marshal Lord Bramall was present. A request for more information.
No. Nope.
Can you help us, Richard?
No, nope, absolutely not. This is totally barred. I would remind you that we have younger listeners, and the full horrors of that event are really too much, you know, too much for anybody, let alone our younger listeners. It's a very painful memory for survivors. The only equivalent for horror is, of course, the great tea trolley disaster of 1967, which very nearly brought down the mighty Chester Perry Empire. So we must keep a veil over this incident.
Well, we now move on to another very important section in Wisdom this year. This was an article on cricket and the environment by Tanya Aldred, another one of this school of brilliant young women cricket journalists. Richard, would you like to talk about that?
I would. This article is a reminder that before coronavirus, global warming and pollution were the greatest threat to cricket, and the cricket world has got to face up to these when it resumes. She talks about the effect on players of playing in temperatures above 35 centigrade, and especially batsmen and wicketkeepers in protective gear, and also the effects of playing in a choking atmosphere. And she points out, and this is a very powerful point to me, that five major cricket cities in the world are on the list of the 10 most polluted cities in the world. And these are Delhi, Lahore, Karachi, Kolkata and Dhaka. And London is not all that far behind. There's also in that section, there's a standalone article by Siddharth Monga about the T20 match in Delhi between India and Bangladesh, when the cricketers were forced to play for commercial reasons in an absolutely unbearable atmosphere when everyone else was actually ordered to stop sport. And this is something cricket has to reflect on, and indeed all world sport. If sport becomes unbearable for temperature and atmospheric reasons for trained athletes, what about all those who aren't match fit, and for older people and for children? And it means that cricket could be unplayable in a generation or less, in, not just in the Indian subcontinent, but in all of its major cities.
Yeah, one of the... there've been a stream of photographs coming out of the subcontinent, particularly in the Punjab, where you're getting pictures of the Himalayas for the first time, where they're seeing them for the first time in their lives. And so the extent of pollution is really being brought home to us. And of course, we had those awful pictures before the virus struck of cricket being played with burning trees in the background and cricketers choking because of the awful forest fires which ripped through Australia quite recently.
Totally. As far as temperature is concerned, I myself once played briefly in a match in Lahore where the temperature reached 48. That's 118 in real Fahrenheit. Meant constant water, not much running, at least even less running from me than usual. There were vultures hovering over the pitch, and they obviously expected lunch any minute at cover point. That match was ended by a violent, something I'd never seen before, a violent electrical sandstorm. Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening, but no rain with it.
I mean, you're creating a picture here of a batsman should fall over or something. They'd be swooping down on him and carrying him away as carcass before he could get up again.
There were a lot of young Pakistanis playing. They were running around as usual in the 48-degree heat, and when the sandstorm came, they wanted to play on. The rest of us retreated into the pavilion pretty smartly.
It brings me on to really a theme which has been dawning on me for several years now. That is the effect of climate change on the length and the longevity of the cricket season. Nowadays, you get the matches starting at the end of March, start of April. Whereas if you look at Wisden, you know, just Wisden 40 years ago, it's really the end of April. It's like there's an extra month at the start of the cricket season because the summer's got so much warmer and it comes so much earlier.
Yes.
Am I imagining things? I mean, I'm sure...
No, you're not imagining things. The season's got... launch of the season's got earlier and earlier. The launch of the first-class season's got earlier and earlier. I think it's only partly about climate. It's also commercially driven. It's to fit in... the county championship gets pushed back further and further to fit in all these competitions that nobody's interested in. And the season, in my view, now has no rhythm at all. Hate to sound like a reactionary, but in the old days, you knew exactly where you stood. The visitors, the season had a pattern. The visitors arrived at the end of April. They played a warm-up game against the Duke of Norfolk's 11. And then they might play one against Colonel Stevens's 11. Then they played Worcestershire. Then you got the test matches, then you got the county championship.
Yeah, that match at Arundel was something, wasn't it? When was that? The end of April? And the Duke would play, he would bat number 11 maybe against the visiting Australians, wouldn't he? The old Duke of Norfolk.
The old Duke of Norfolk.
Who had arranged Her Majesty's coronation, of course, in 1952, hadn't he?
53, coronation.
53, yes.
Yeah. Yes, he was. There was a convention. The Duke did like to play in the match, and there was a convention that no one appealed against the Duke, but apparently one young Australian fast bowler got carried away when he hit the Duke on the pads and appealed, and the Duke was given out by his butler with the magnificent words, "His Grace is not in."
Didn't he manage an England cricket tour of Australia? Am I dreaming?
He certainly did manage it. It was Dexter's tour in 62-63. They didn't have anybody available, apparently, as the manager. And they were discussing this in front of the Duke, and he said, well, there's nobody else. I'll do it. And they liked him a lot in Australia as the manager. Got on very well there. I think they called him Dukey in press conferences. Hey, Dukey, what's, you know, who are you picking for the first test?
They're a bit prickly, those Australians. I mean, didn't they take exception to his patrician manner and all the rest of it?
I think, as I remember, he got on pretty well. He was quite affable. The only problem was he had to go back in that tour to arrange Winston Churchill's funeral.
That's quite a serious interruption.
Well, it was the end of his tour. We remember Churchill's great funeral, and it was would have been a major event for the Duke as...
A massive event, yeah.
It's the old Marshal.
Now, I recall that Colin Cowdrey was on that tour. He later went on to marry one of the Duke's daughters. And I was told about this by my friend Lord Lothian, then Michael Ancram, because he did the same thing. He also married a daughter of the Duke.
So they became brothers-in-law.
They became brothers-in-law. And more than that, they used to write poems to each other, I think I'm right in saying. He and Colin Cowdrey, who later entered the House of Lords, used to have had a lovely correspondence about cricket, and mainly, I think, in poetry. I remember this because Ancram, or Lord Lothian as he now is, told me this.
That's fascinating. Have these poems ever been published?
No, and I think they ought to be. I remember urging Michael Ancram, after Colin Cowdrey died, that maybe this was the moment to publish them as a little sort of book of reminiscence.
Very much so.
But at any rate, David Frost was the other one who married a daughter of the Duke of Norfolk. And he, I don't know if it's a complete coincidence, but Frost ended up in Poets Corner after he died.
Did he really?
Alongside Tennyson and other great poets. I don't think his poetry was all that up to much, actually, David Frost.
I didn't know he'd written any, but did he greet his fellow poets with the words, hello, good evening and welcome?
Yeah, I bet that, exactly.
When he reached the Elysian Fields, or whatever destination, did he, is that how he, yes. So many, if he did go to a higher place, so many wonderful people for him to interview, David Frost.
Yes, it would have been absolute. Yes, the Frost show up there. Yes,
he never got past St. Peter at the gate. He'd have been interviewing St. Peter himself rather than the other way round.
Yes, asking him, you know, what about how he felt when the cock crowed for the third time, St. Peter. Yes. And we were talking about the structure of the English cricket season as it used to be before the current incumbents sort of moved it and turned it all into an amorphous, shapeless mass. And then you had the Scarborough Festival, where, you know, it wasn't all, I mean, Tofts, was it? And you had the Scarborough Festival, you had the Canterbury Festival.
There's one at Hastings as well. You had some light-hearted cricket to close the season, and then England might be on tour. Anyway, there was something for every month. You knew where you were every month of the year.
You mentioned earlier in the month, early on, that Colonel Stevens 11 against the visiting touring team. Who was Colonel Stevens? Because I never heard of that one.
His name comes up, and I'm sorry to say I didn't have time to look him up, so that's something we may come back to next week as a matter arising. I'd love to hear from listeners. Who was Colonel Stevens? Why does he get an 11? Did he play himself? All good questions.
I do think that it is time now that they, because everybody's got a bit of time to think, we ought to try and work out an English season which does get back a structure which makes sense to the spectators, is rather than is all crammed in rather a sort of squidgy way, which doesn't have any kind of soul to it. The test matches now suddenly get crammed in at the back end of the season, and then there's another set far too early. One of the things I really dislike, you get Sri Lanka or the West Indies, lovely sides, they turn up and they've come and gone by the end of May. And there's no way you're ever going to get the West Indies, for instance, who are glorious stroke players, arriving in May when the wickets are green and it's moving around. They really need July or August to be at their greatest. The same applies to the Sri Lankans. And I feel that people are being taken for granted, rather, at the moment.
I think that's right. It's also, if there's double tours, nobody likes being the first half of the tour. And I think if you look statistically, sides that come in the first half never do as well. They're coming from abroad to an early English season of unpredictable pitches and unpredictable weather.
It's a bit like an aperitif before the main course, isn't it? Which is slightly indigestible sometimes. I do think so. By the way, I've been trying to get a hold of Henry Blofeld because I want to know how his reaction to that Alex Massey review, which I felt unnecessarily rude. But I got a message back from Blowers, but he hadn't spoken to me. He says that he's in Norfolk doing his best and the wine at the local Waitrose is okay. He's not dying of thirst, he said.
Well, I'm very relieved to hear that. Unjust and bitter as Alex Massey was to Henry Blofeld, he did something even more cruel to our friend Mihir Bose.
He's not coming out of this very well, Massey. What's he done to Bose?
Well, he managed to review 21 cricket books, Alex, which is quite a lot, actually. But he missed out 9 Waves, which is the magisterial complete history of Indian cricket by Mihir.
How can he have done that?
It's a real howler. So I'll just better repeat that title, dictation speed. 9 Waves.
9 Waves by Mihir Bose. Yeah. That is, 9 Waves is an account of India's transformation into a cricket superpower. It's beyond doubt the biggest story of modern cricket and one of the biggest of all contemporary sport. And Mihir Bose is part of the canon of Indian cricket writers.
Very much so. 20 years ago, the mere mention of Mihir Bose got me and my partner a hotel room from Air India when our flight to Delhi was cancelled, as so often happens, for fog.
Yeah, and we took a number of cricket tours, actually, to India, which were amazing. We played in a number of Test match stadiums. In fact, I remember, Richard, it's just come to me now, you dropped a catch, didn't you, off my bowling? It was in Madras, wasn't it?
Yes, Madras, as they in Chennai. We were playing the Tamil Nadu Journalists Association. I have to say, I made such a pig's ear of that catch. I not only dropped it, but I'm making a big effort to catch it. I actually tipped it over the boundary for 6.
Yeah, it was a sitter, and you sort of...
It wasn't a sitter, it was swirling. It was swirling in the air, and there were vultures hovering. No, I made that bit up. But it was difficult. It was swirling and spinning away from me. I made a big effort to catch it, and I only succeeded in tipping it over the boundary for 6.
Yeah, it was painful, particularly since Tim Jatiski, our wicketkeeper, had missed a stumping off me the previous ball.
Oh, horrible.
It's all coming back. It's painful. Do you remember England A were playing in the big stadium and we were in the little stadium? Nursery ground, yeah. And the crowd kind of moved over to watch us because we were much more fun than watching Nick Knight sort of ground out 50 in about 75 overs.
Well,
you remember
indeed.
Them. They were dull, the England A.
The Tamil Nadu Journalists Association were batting against our attack. In the time that England A grannied to about 20 for 1, the Tamil Nadu Journalists Association made about 150. So, as you say, the crowd emptied from the stadium and gradually sort of looked over the stands to the nursery ground and assembled around the nursery ground. And so I had a big crowd for my misdemeanour out at deep mid-wicket. And I have to say I became a hero of that crowd in Chennai, Madras as it then was. I've never had such a reception on a cricket field. Every time I touched the ball from then on, it was wild applause. They obviously thought it was a miracle that I touched the ball after that effort at a catch.
It still rankles, Richard.
Been allowed to forget it, have I? I've never been allowed. You know, I think it's gone. I think it might have been buried, but no, it gets revived regularly. We were talking, though, about the terrible injustice. Try and get it off my catch. We were talking about the terrible injustice to Mihir of ignoring his book. And the fact is that Wisden's reviewer has tremendous power because if he or she misses your book, it disappears into a list in terribly, terribly small print of books received. And Wisden's print is the one snag you can't avoid every year. They could actually use it in opticians for testing, you know, like, now, can you read the name of the counties in this match? Good. And now the initials of Burgess, the number 7. Good. But now, can you manage the books received? Astonishing! You know, that's better than 2020.
Publishers might be tempted to do some sort of precaution against this type of systematic malign neglect.
Well, it might do as a precaution. They could start publishing books with immensely long titles, as they used to have in the 18th century. And as in Mihir's book, it might have been titled The Complete History of Indian Cricket from the Earliest Colonial Times unto the modern era, rigorously analysed under 9 phases by that foremost authority on the same, Mihir Bose Esquire. And Wisden would have had to publish all that, even if it gave no review.
Presumably you're going to apply this technique to your next cricket novel, just in case it gets missed by the selectors.
Oh, yes. Leaving nothing to chance, the working title is Cricket Fiction's Long-Awaited Masterpiece, Wisden 2021.
I think we're talking about fiction here, Richard. But anyway, moving on from the book's pages, I mean, you do get all kinds of amazing facts in Wisden, one of which, and I love this fact because it highlights something which is absolutely the most wonderful thing about the game of cricket in the last 10 years. It highlights the achievement of Afghan cricket. Afghanistan, which has been through so much of a nightmare, has been devastated for 20 years, so much suffering, yet has produced a test match team. And now we get, Richard, you're better on this than me. You've got the fastest first-class double hundred ever scored.
Shafiqullah Shinwari. He's obviously a member of the important Afghan clan of Shinwaris. He scored 200 in 103 minutes off just 89 balls. He scored it for Kabul versus Boost. And it's wonderful to know that there's a first-class cricket team called Boost, which I think is almost as good a name as the Nondescripts, one of the best clubs in Sri Lanka. I don't know where Nondescripts comes from. Sounds like the sort of club we might play for and against.
Very much so. You wouldn't be surprised at all to have a sort of grudge match against Nondescripts, would we? But I never knew that there was a Sri Lankan Nondescripts. What I have been aware of for a long time is the kind of teams which we reported in our book on Pakistan cricket, Richard. You know, the gas workers or the airlines or the banks or the public sector workers all had their teams.
That's the legacy of the great A.H. Kardar, of course, who was the invented that model of kind of semi-professional or state-sponsored cricket in the 70s. My favourite teams in there are Sui Northern Gas Pipelines and their bitter rival Sui Southern Gas Pipelines. A lot of very famous cricketers have been imitation gas fitters. I think Misbah's played for at least one of the gas teams. Another very important team is the Khan Research Laboratories.
AQ Khan Research Laboratories, which of course Misbah was, I think, captain on. Of course, AQ Khan, some people may not know this, is a national hero in Pakistan, but he was responsible for assembling Pakistan's nuclear bomb. And the AQ Khan Research Laboratories has been a very successful team in what do they call the first class cricket division?
In the Kariazam Trophy. Yes, I think they've won it once or twice.
Most really good Pakistan players have played for AQ Khan, who we tried to get hold of AQ Khan when we were researching our book, Richard.
Well, we got a long interview. We didn't get hold of him ourselves, but our friend Najm Latif had a very long conversation with him, which we did manage to record.
I mean, one of the things I wanted to know in particular, you know, when AQ Khan was working in Europe in the 1960s, doing his best to find out about nuclear bombs, how he kept in touch with, you know, what was going on back at home, cricket-wise, because he's clearly a very, very keen cricket follower.
Well, he did keep in touch with the scores, which is harder to do then because there weren't so much, obviously no internet and any communication, but he followed them avidly from whatever he could get in newspapers, word of mouth and radio. Just wanted to make a little point about that Shinwari record, the Afghan batsman's record. It highlights, first of all, that it's a massive job for statisticians worldwide, keeping up with all the new cricket countries, especially if they take in T20 entrants from countries like Bhutan and Mali. And it also shows how important scorers are in new countries in recording information that satisfies statisticians, especially when these new countries claim records. And also, now that cricketers, as we said earlier, are being bought and sold like commodities, it's vital for the commercial side of the game that records are kept accurately of players' performance. And so I think a small cheer for all the scorers in these new countries and what an important part of their infrastructure they are. Scorers are often unsung, although I have to say, can I just mention that I made the scorer the most important character in my first cricket novel, A Tale of 10 Wickets. And can I just repeat that title at dictation speed? A Tale of 10 Wickets.
Yes, he plays rather the same role, wouldn't you say, of the narrator Jenkins in Dance to the Music of Time, the omniscient narrator, perhaps. Is that fair?
It's very fair. He's my book isn't quite as long as A Dance to the Music of Time. You can get through that one fairly smartly in an afternoon.
Not much about cricket in Dance to the Music of Time. Nothing, in fact. I want to move on, though, to the foreign section. Actually, in this superb wisdom, I mean, you keep on discovering fresh delights. And the foreign section is even better than usual. I mean, and there's two particularly moving entries. One is from Mali, which is a very troubled part of North Africa, where Al-Qaeda has been very busy for a few years. In fact, I think the jihadis took Timbuktu in its capital in 2011 or 12. But a man called Phil Watson, I don't know anything about him, except that he's provided a report from Mali of the cricket there, which of course has been a bit wretched. They were all out for six. Extras top scored with five against Rwanda. Subsequent totals, these are the Mali women, by the way, the Kwibuka Women's Tournament in Kigali. Mali scored 11, 10, 30 for 9, 17 and 14. But what was, obviously it's tough going, isn't it, Richard? That even by our standards, that's bad scoring.
That's even worse than Pakistan's pioneering women's cricket team in their first World Cup. Like that Pakistan team, it's a great sign of hope that it's there at all, women's cricket in Mali.
Very much so. And it's a very moving account by Phil Watson of how he lived in Mali and went to many lengths to set up La Fédération. It's French-speaking part of the world. Malien de cricket. And he's sort of done a huge amount in teaching the game, creating the conditions in which it can be played. And I really would love to hail a figure like Miss. I did something, nothing less much like that, but I went to Chad 15 years ago at the height of the Darfur tragedy when the Janjaweed were massacring the Darfuris, and I lived in the Chad border for a while. Our translator had learnt his English in Nigeria, and he'd not just learnt English, but he learnt cricket, and he came back to Chad with a mission of setting up cricket in Chad. And I did everything I could to help him, including send a whole mass of cricket gear. We got everybody to give me stuff and we sent it back out there to Chad. And they formed the cricket league, which they briefly called the Peter Oborn Cricket League, because it was of all the kit I'd sent them. And I don't know what's happened to Chad cricket since then. And Lebanon, another similar kind of story. There's a man called James Gray out there who's a cricket-loving Scottish headmaster. Now, he's set up cricket, including in the Shatila refugee camps in Beirut. Again, off they are, down to the Bekaa Valley, spreading the gospel of cricket in war-torn Lebanon. I find these stories very profound and deeply moving.
They are. It's there's something of a tradition, of course, of Britain's exporting British sports to far-flung places. It's really why soccer and rugby caught on in so many places. But to bring cricket to places like Mali and Lebanon in those conditions is really, really quite special.
And then, of course, the most interesting, I mean, again, it's just, Wisden is so full of the most amazing material. So I then looked at Ecuador, and lo and behold, there's an account of Julian Assange's. Now, he's in Belmarsh at the moment with the US trying to extradite him to the United States on espionage charges. And I've been a little bit involved in the campaign to stop the US getting their hands on him because that'll be that if he gets out there. Anyway, we learn that in Ecuador, the attitude taken to him by the Ecuadorian president Lenin Moreno has caused consternation among Ecuador's cricketers. And some have written to Assange offering honorary membership of Quito CC. Now, apparently they wrote to him at Belmarsh Prison, where he is in bad health, and they've not received a reply. Anyway, last week I put in a request to some of Assange's close supporters for information about Julian Assange's cricket. Being Australian, it's quite likely that he will have got cricket associations, and whether he's a follower and what record he has of playing the game, and whether indeed he ever has received the invitation to become an honorary member of Quito. And I haven't yet received a reply, but I'll bring news of that.
Well, look forward to that. Certainly mentions in Wisden, he's born in Queensland. He's very proud of his cricketing grandparents and antecedents. Made me think, you don't associate Julian Assange with cricket. That's an amazing revelation from Wisden, but makes you think of all the cricketers you do know who have, at some time or other, been victims of politics, victims of oppressive regimes. The best known, I suppose, would be Andy Flower and Henry Alonga in Zimbabwe.
Who were so bravely put on the black armbands in the World Cup in 2003 when they were playing, I think it was in Zimbabwe, against England, and they wore black armbands as a symbol of their protest against the conduct of President Mugabe's regime at the time. Nasser Hussain was the England captain. I remember speaking to him about it.
That was a global story, that one. But we can name some famous Pakistani cricketers who've been victims of politics in one way or another, victims of oppression. Javed Berkey, who's a former captain, was arrested and detained on trumped-up charges. Our friend Aftab Gul, who was a radical supporter of Zede Bhutto, had to escape the Zia dictatorship had to escape charges of capital crimes based on planted evidence.
And of course, there were Bangladeshi players at that time, East Pakistan players, in 1971, who had a very difficult journey to make, didn't they? Richard, your memory is better than mine, probably.
Best known of them is Rockyball Hassan. Rockyball Hassan was a teenager, and they wanted to make him a sort of poster boy for East Pakistan cricket and for Pakistan cricket in general, but he wasn't having any of that, and he escaped to join the Bangladesh independence struggle. And fortunately, I think, well, he did survive it, and I think he became a force in Bangladesh cricket when it got going itself. Another example, in a way, of victims of politics were the wonderful Khan sisters, whom we've written about extensively, the pioneers of women's cricket. They had to fight against the infamous Hudood anti-women ordinances in the very extreme religious regime of Zia, which tried to confine women to their homes, more or less. And they faced constant pressures from government and religious extremists, including death threats. And it was very sad to hear of the early death of the younger sister, Sharmeen Khan, and that was in Wisden last year. And it makes one think that if there are famous cricketers who can fall foul of politics, there are millions or more who aren't known at all, who must be victims of persecution and violence and war. Just thinking not just of current cricketers, but retired ones and spectators and fans, and probably especially cricket journalists.
I think we're coming towards close of play now. Perhaps this is a theme we will investigate. And if anybody wanted to get in touch with suggestions, they should send an email.
Yes, indeed. I was thinking that there might be a global pressure group for cricketing victims of oppression, persecution and violence. Might even call it cricketers of conscience. And if anybody's got any suggestions related to that, particularly of cricketers and cricketing locations which are suffering in that sort of way, love to hear them on my reserve email, harryb4848, or one word, harryb4848 at yahoo.co.uk.
Well, that is close of play for today, but we will be back next week. And if you want to send a message to Richard's email address, please do.
Be very glad to hear from you about anything at all. Next week, apart from any follow-up on cricketing victims of persecution, we'll be revealing more of the Philosopher's Cricket Team, and I'll try and reveal a bit more about Colonel Stevens and his role in cricket.
Well, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me, Richard Heller. Thank you very much.